Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. As we've often said here at For the People, there's always something wild happening at Connecticut's only zoo, and 2022 marks the 100th anniversary of the Beardsley Zoo in Bridgeport. So we're kicking off a year's worth of zoo-centric segments with our longtime partner and zoo director, Greg Dancho, to learn a bit about its history and what's in store for the zoo's centennial year. Then we're going to stick with an environmental theme as we check in with a pair of conservation experts from the state's USDA offices for a lesson on conservation easements and the many ways these land, water, and soil-saving initiatives benefit our communities and the environment. And we'll close with a brand-new organization on For the People working to share the benefits of self-care through meditation, the Community Mindfulness Project. Could you afford to have a little more peace and a little less stress in your life? Well, stay tuned. We may have the solution. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. The Connecticut Department of Revenue Services 2021 Tax Amnesty Program that we featured recently on For the People is offering individuals and businesses the opportunity to pay back taxes at a reduced interest rate with no penalties. And that program is ending January 31st. The program offers a 75% reduction in interest and waives penalties and the possibility of criminal prosecution to those who have not filed, have underreported, or have existing liabilities related to taxes owed to the state for any tax period ending on or before December 31st, 2020. Taxpayers seeking amnesty can access all program information, including a link to the secure online payment portal via the Tax Amnesty Program website, getrightct.com. But you got to act before January 31st or it's all over. That's right. Getrightct.com. One of my favorite people, not just because I've been a fan of his workplace virtually since I was able to hold my mother's hand and walk through the Beardsley Zoo. Greg Dancho is with us again. He's been a regular resource to the award-winning For the People now for going on 30 years in my tenure, and he has been a spectacular resource and diplomat on behalf of zoos for much longer, Greg, and we hope that your career continues for many more years because you're doing such great work.
Thank you, John.
We don't want to hear about a retirement announcement, but even though there's bigger news at the Beardsley Zoo this year, yes, 100 years of doing the zoo here in Greater Bridgeport. You're celebrating your centennial year there at the Beardsley Zoo. So I thought we'd start the first of a series of interviews we're going to be doing over this centennial year with you and start the whole conversation kind of rolling it all the way back to a century ago. How did this whole thing get started?
Well, first of all, John, 30 years, man. We're talking to you for 30. It's been had a long run there. It's been a good run.
Yes.
In 30 years. Yeah, I just finished up my 42nd year working here at the zoo in January 3rd.
Yeah.
So I just passed my anniversary there. And it's interesting that I have been affiliated with the zoo since 1975. So I had another 5 years to that.
Mm-hmm.
So 47 years I've been affiliated with the zoo, and we're just past. Are just into our 100th year celebration. So I'm thinking, wow, it's been almost half the zoo's existence I've been involved here, and it's been quite a ride, like you said. It's been a lot of fun, and where we're going now is really going to be exciting. Where we started with way back when, and we got to go back to James Beardsley, who was the person who donated the land to Bridgeport. To have an open park up here 2.5 miles from downtown Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
So you're 2.5 miles down to downtown to Beardsley Park, basically almost straight down Noble Avenue. And back then there was a industrial revolution going on. So down in the city, people were working and living down there. And when Beardsley donated the land, he wanted to have a place for people to get out into the country. So imagine that, you know, many years ago. People would go 2.5 miles to get to the country.
Yeah, get on the streetcar and head up to the north end of Bridgeport there.
Exactly.
And enjoy the wide open spaces.
The wide open spaces of Beardsley. And so that's previous to the zoo, but that kind of starts the whole ball rolling because then P.T. Barnum, as we know, was the mayor of Bridgeport. He's also, you know, P.T. Barnum Circus.
Yes.
And in Wentfield, right off of 95, if you're driving down 95, heading to New York City and going through the city of Bridgeport, and as you're going out the other side, going down toward New York, on the right-hand side of I-95, you may see a couple ball fields that are right alongside the highway there, right alongside the railroad spur. And that is where P.T. Barnum Circus used to have their animals down there. They used to winter some of the animals down there, and then move that as a place where they go off to other places to show off their circus.
Yep.
And because they were down there, again, being down, that's, again, about 2.5 miles from Beardsley Park, there was nothing really going on down there. So some of the animals would be given walks. They'd be put in trailers. They'd be bringing up to Beardsley Park, and they'd walk around on the grounds here because it was designed with open fields and roadways so they could park their vehicles here and let the animals kind of get out and walk around. You know, the elephants and some giraffes and things of that nature would walk around. That got people kind of excited. Predating the zoo itself was the greenhouse. The greenhouse was up here in 1875 was built. And so we had a greenhouse up on grounds. There was some buildings, maintenance buildings on grounds, but there was no zoo. People were bringing parrots to the greenhouse, again, because plants and animals, you know, really go together, and mm-hmm. they still do today. People would bring some parrots up, and I've got some old photographs of some cockatoos that were donated to the greenhouse, and they'd put them out on the lawn. So as you're out on the lawn of the greenhouse, and there was the plants all around there, you would also have some animals sitting outside.
Hmm.
So Wesley Hayes, who was a park commissioner, was kind of, you know, as a Bridgeport park commissioner, took note of this. He took note of the animals that were coming up, you know, and walking around Beardsley Park from the circus, and he took note of some of the animals that were being donated to the greenhouse that people could see, and thought, well, why don't we put a zoo together, you know, and we could have a zoo. Because back then, if you were a city that didn't have a zoo, it was kind of one of those things you had to have. Mm-hmm. It was really one of those really popular things for a city, especially a burgeoning city, a city that was growing, to have a zoo so their residents could have a place to go and have recreation and get away, again, away from their jobs for a little bit and have some fun.
Mm.
And so basically, he started that process of getting the zoo put together. In reality, Connecticut had about 7 zoos in the cities around the state of Connecticut. We are the only one that has survived now over the years. So basically our humble beginning started with some animals in the greenhouse and somebody having a vision to build a zoo here.
It sounds like it really developed quite organically from the extension of P.T. Barnum and his animal keepers, and then the good folks of Bridgeport who had some tropical birds that came down, and it's all grown up from there. But also, it's been a long-standing educational entity because it has helped to educate many generations on how zoos actually aid and enhance species preservation.
Yeah, and again, as zoos evolve, the 100 years go on, the zoo's mission evolves a little bit. You know, back then, again, it was for people to come out and get some recreation, see the animals.
Yep.
About $50,000 was donated given to the into the budget of the city of Bridgeport to start the zoo. And so, again, those humble beginnings started it. And then over time, you know, we've had some milestones over the 100 years. And those milestones have been very, very important. And some of them have been the creation of the rainforest building. It used to be the monkey house. Everybody remembers the monkey house back then. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the biggest projects that was undertaken by the city back in the 50s when the zoo was still growing and they were still trying to get more things going on with the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And so the old monkey house, the bird mammal building, is actually the correct term for it. That was a place that actually was on the cover of a national magazine. The cover of a national magazine, when that was the construction was complete, they had it. So they were talking about the new way that zoos were being built, how exhibits, animals were being displayed. And this was a state of the art, and how exciting this was that zoos were evolving. And it's amazing because that evolution has gone light years ahead to now, because back then when they did the rainforest building, or the bird mammal building, the old monkey house, that basically what they had was cubicle style holding areas that had porcelain tile walls. And the reason for that was because you had to keep cleanliness was mm-hmm. very important.
Sure.
Back then, when we had zoos, people, the zoo veterinarian world had not really pushed forward as it is today. So really the first line of defense to keep animals healthy and alive was to really clean, you know? And so even though right today you would not say that old monkey house would be in any stretch of imagination a state-of-the-art area for keeping animals, it's where people started thinking about how we better can take care of animals. And again, that evolutionary process has been going, it goes on and continues to go on as today. So again, those big areas, I remember coming here as a child and seeing the old bear habitat that we had here, or the bear cage that we had here, which was very small. And again, not to today's standards. But again, people thought of the zoos differently back then. Yeah. Zoos were thought kind of as a menagerie. It was, again, they wanted to see something that they normally wouldn't see. Now, again, today, you know, there's so many ways to see animals from around the world. Back then, you had to realize there was, what did you have?
Yes.
Really, TV wasn't there. You didn't have... You definitely didn't have, you know, computers were not even in anybody's imagination.
Yeah, zoos, so circuses, rodeos, that's it.
Yeah, to see these animals. And some people will say, well, those were the bad old days of the menagerie when people, you know, would see these animals and really kind of the conditions that really were not what we see today. But that also started people thinking of how we and why we should protect animals. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really a starter, because if you didn't have that one-on-one relationship or that interaction back then, you know, people would have not cared.
Right.
You know,
you make a
really
personal connection. Yeah.
To make that personal connection, and that's true today. But back then, the personal connection was very, very important for those people that would go on to be the E.O. Wilsons, who just passed away, unfortunately, who is a tremendous ecologist and conservationist and scientist about the rainforest and things. But I'll kind of say, without knowing personally, that I have met E.O. Wilson. He started out by going to zoos when he was a kid, and that got his interest perked.
Great.
And that's why he went on to do the wonderful things he did.
Okay.
So again, that was the important thing.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes left in our next visit planned, probably for sometime late March, early April. Between now and then, are there any big tent post activities that are happening in regards to the anniversary that you can just remind us about quickly?
Yeah, right now what we're doing at the zoo is, first of all, we changed our logo this year to just for the 100th anniversary, our celebration. We worked with the students of University of Bridgeport. They did a tremendous job to help us develop a logo that we could use. So that logo now is on our website. They can take a look at that.
Okay.
We are getting prepared to open for the 100th anniversary of the Andean Bear Habitat. And the Andean Bear Habitat is under construction right now. Right now we are planning for a late spring, early summer opening, bringing bears back to the zoo that have not been here for many years. We had Andean bear for a while. We had black bear before that. So bringing bears back to the zoo for the 100th anniversary, I think, is very, very apropos. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the year, just keep looking. We're going to have a lot of little different things. So we really want people to go to our website and our Facebook page, especially, because we're going to be doing FaceTimes. We're going to be talking about the history. We want people to actually, if they have old photographs, like I have when I was 1 year old, sitting on the lion that was out front of the greenhouse of the old Bird Mail building.
Right.
If people have all those old pictures, we'd like them to scan them and send them to us via the website, so we can show people the history and the really the people that have been affected by the zoo over time. And it's, again, I've been very proud to be part of this, and I'm really proud of the things that we're going to be doing this year and then in the future.
Well, Greg Dancho, thank you so much once again for your attention to detail and caring so much and your passion for the Beardsley Zoo and the animals that it hosts. We will be talking to you and your team again a number of times over the course of this 100th anniversary year. But in the meantime, start the excitement at beardsleyzoo.org. The zoo is open daily 9 to 4. They'd love to see you at any point during the winter, and we will return in the spring, Greg. Thank you so much. Well, as we mentioned in our introduction, something that has a lot of benefit to both the environment and communities wherever they occur is something called a conservation easement. And we have a couple of folks on the line this morning who are going to give us a little radio lesson and talk a little bit about these programs from the USDA. We're so pleased to have the Connecticut NRCS state conservationist Tom Morgart with us, as well as the assistant state conservationist for programs, Carol Grassis. So great to meet you guys. I've been very, very pleased and honored to have a lot of your colleagues on the program over the year, and it's always both very educational and informative to me as well as our listeners. We get a lot of feedback when the USDA is on. A lot of times we're talking about agriculture and farming, and this does have a little bit to do with it, because I guess folks who own a huge amount of agricultural land who may be downsizing or not staying in the farm business as they had in generations past are looking for ways to conserve their land without having to necessarily sell it off and risk that that land might be used in a way that they and their predecessors would want to see it. So I thought it was really important to bring you guys in to help educate community leaders and listeners who put these community leaders in office about the importance of supporting programs like conservation easements. So let me just start by saying, Tom, if you wouldn't mind just giving us a little bit more background on the NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Certainly. So NRCS is a part of the USDA. So I used an acronym already, Natural Resources Conservation Service. We call it NRCS, is a part of the USDA. And I like to say we help farmers farm in more environmentally friendly ways. And that includes putting easements on properties to help protect that land in perpetuity going into the future.
And before we get into digging in really kind of more deeply into the subject matter, can you just give folks a little bit of an idea of some of the other types of programs that help either sustain our farms here in Connecticut or help communities decide what to do with land that may have been formerly used for agriculture?
Certainly, I'd be happy to do that. So beyond our easement programs, we have a program called EQIP. That's the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. And that program is really designed on helping landowners treat a resource concern on their property. So if you're interested in making your farm more resilient to climate change, we have practices that can help you with that. If you have an irrigation system that isn't working very well, we can help you make that irrigation system improve that, improve your energy use on your farm. Lots of different types of practices we can do through the EQIP program. I'd like to say that we go from A to Z in the alphabet soup of helping you treat your resource concerns. We have another program called the Agricultural Management Assistance Program. And in that program, we typically focus in the state in helping people treat their resource concerns. One of them is our season is pretty short here in Connecticut, so we can help you get a high tunnel. And it's the only program we have inside of NRCS that lets you get a brand new irrigation system if you haven't had one in the past. We have the Conservation Stewardship Program, and that program really is working with landowners who have already implemented a large amount of conservation on their farm. And then we help bring them to the next level up. So we lift that conservation effort they've already done a little bit higher and help them treat their resource concern even to a higher level.
Excellent. Very good. And?
Side of our, what I'll call our financial assistance programs, we have other programs. So watershed programs where we can help localities treat erosion that's going on in their area. We have an emergency watershed protection program where we've done a lot of work in the West Haven area where we have working with the town, put easements on properties that routinely flooded. Mm-hmm. And we've torn down the homes. We've bought the people out of their homes that were routinely flooding due to large storm events. Then we take down their home and restore that area to the natural, as close to the natural floodplain as we can get it. Mm-hmm. So we're taking people out of harm's way and helping them move to an area of higher ground where they don't, not at risk of flooding anymore.
So
we have a lot of programs in NRCS, and if any of these interest you, we encourage you to look at our webpage. And that's, if you Google Connecticut NRCS, you can see everything we offer there.
I was going to say, so you guys are going to be a great resource, Tom, and I dare say we may be talking to you again sooner than later when we really start ramping up our coverage on the impacts of global warming to various communities, industries, and entities here in Connecticut, because it sounds like you guys are working on a number of programs, both at the coast and inland, that are responding to global warming and changes in our weather systems and things like that. So it's great to be able to hear about all these programs and gives me a lot of ideas to make some lists to call you back again. But flipping back now to the main event, conservation easements, this is something I've had the opportunity to report on in several instances in terms of preserving family farms here in Connecticut. So in your words, can you explain to our listeners some of the benefits of someone putting an easement on their agricultural land? I guess in a lot of ways, it's it plays the same role as the easements in West Haven in terms of, you know, conserving and protecting the property, right?
Absolutely. That's the key thing, that we're preserving these properties in perpetuity. And the reason we're at NRCS are so interested in this is, one, since from 1992 to 2017, Connecticut has lost 11.4% of our prime soils to development. Prime soils are the best soils in the state, and that adds up to just short of 31,000 acres. So we are really interested in preventing the conversion of productive agricultural land to non-agricultural uses. And really, this is critically important to our food supply. It's even more important right today because we have supply chain disruptions. The more food we can produce locally, the less impacted we are by these supply chain problems. Plus, we will be able to be supporting our local economy, not the economies far away. So it's really important for this local support that we can provide to our local farms to save these properties. In addition to that, we are providing a lot of other public benefits, including environmental quality, historic preservation of historic sites. We preserve wildlife habitat and protect open space. In addition to that, when we talk about an agricultural land easement, putting an easement on these prime soils, we're developing local and statewide partnerships. So we're putting like-minded people together to raise funds for these types of projects and look at the long-term stewardship of these projects. So it's not like we're there today and gone tomorrow. We are connected to these properties in perpetuity, encouraging those landowners to put additional conservation on their properties to enhance, like you just mentioned, the activities that help sequester carbon to slow the effect of climate change in Connecticut.
Sure. And as we, as I learned a long time ago, you know, bringing a box of Brussels sprouts from, you know, a Colombia or Mexico to your favorite grocery big box here in Connecticut spends a huge amount of pollutants and makes a huge carbon footprint versus maybe the Brussels sprouts that are raised in a hydroponic greenhouse right here in, you know, Simsbury or Enfield, right?
Absolutely. I didn't mention one of the biggest benefits to the landowner. When we work with these partners locally to put an easement on their property, there's a financial benefit to the landowner as well. They get a payment for that easement.
So a huge benefit to the community, to the property owner, and to the environment as well. We appreciate your giving us that primer on easements, Tom. And we're going to come back and talk to Carol more about the program, as well as you, about how the land could be used after an easement and put on, and how successful these programs have been to date. We are talking with a couple of friends from the USDA, the Connecticut NRCS State Conservationist. Tom Morgart is with us, as well as Assistant State Conservationist for Programs, Carol Grassis. Folks, stick with us. We'll be back to talk more about conservation easements right after this break. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. It's the most wonderful time of the year for cookie lovers, that is. The official launch of the Girl Scouts of Connecticut's annual cookie season is on. The popular program includes its newest addition, Adventurefuls, a new decadent brownie-inspired cookie with caramel-flavored cream and a hint of sea salt, as another means to fundraise for the statewide nonprofit while teaching girls the important lessons of goal setting, decision making, business ethics, people skills, and money management. If you know a registered Girl Scout, reach out to her to find out how she's selling cookies in a way that meets local, state, and CDC safety protocols, including via the digital cookie online platform. And if you don't know a Girl Scout and you want some cookies, just visit gsofct.org. Yummy. Well, thanks for joining us. If you are recently tuning in, and for those who stuck with us through the break, the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program provides financial and technical assistance to help conserve farmland and wetlands and their related benefits. And we're talking with a couple of folks who can tell you all about it, and they certainly have been so far. We're pleased to make the acquaintance of Tom Morgart, Connecticut's NRCS State Conservationist, and Assistant State Conservationist for Programs. Carol Grassis is on the line with us. So Carol, having heard all the lead up to this, tell us a little bit more about how the conservation easement program works in practical application.
Hi, John. Thanks for the opportunity to talk today. As Tom mentioned, the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program is an easement program that NRCS runs throughout the nation. And in Connecticut, we have a program that has two arms. The first one I'm going to talk about is the agricultural land easement portion of this program. And of course, the goal of this is to protect the best farmland soils from being developed, as Tom mentioned. That's our first primary goal. And then we also have all of those other benefits that Tom mentioned. So this program is designed around a cost-sharing program agreement between NRCS and another cooperating entity. And when I say that, I mean a group like a land trust, the State Department of Agriculture, or a local unit of government, like a town. These entities already have land preservation programs, and they have a history of holding easements, and we work with them to enroll interested parcels from landowners. So a farmer or a landowner would apply to one of those cooperating entities first. They would get enrolled into the land trust programs or through the State Department of Ag's PDR, which is the Purchase of Development Rights Program. And they would come to an agreement with that entity about the configuration of the land. How much of their land do they want to enroll? And they would come to an agreement on an estimated value of the easement. And then that entity will apply to NRCS to cost share and to share the responsibilities of the ASEP AIL easement that would get placed in the future. So NRCS advertises application batching dates each year, one or more of them. This year we've advertised our first round is January 28th, and then our second round is March 4th of this year. At that batching date, we would look at the applications that come in from the cooperating entities. So these entities might bring us one parcel, they might bring us 10 parcels. We look at all the parcels that we get and we'll rank them. And assuming we have enough money, we can actually create an agreement between us and the entity to move forward and eventually put an easement on the land. So that's under the ASEP AIL, or the agricultural land easement portion. Mm-hmm. We also have a wetland reserve easement, or the ASEP WRE. And that's a little different, and it's actually an agreement between NRCS and the landowner themselves. So a landowner might have areas of their farm that they've historically farmed, but they always knew that it was, you know, wet, and it might be a farmed wetland or something like that. And again, with climate change, we're seeing more infrequent precipitation events, and some of these areas are going to become more and more difficult to farm in the future. We can take an application directly from that landowner and develop a configuration that works for everyone and put an easement on that land and basically remove that land from production and restore the hydrology and restore the wetland functions and values in that area to benefit both the landowner and anything, you know, resources around, including wildlife and water quality.
Sure. Water table. The benefits are quite expansive once you really kind of drill down into all of the things that a conservation easement can do, both for the property owner involved as well as the neighbors and the community around it and the entire state. How long do these easements typically last? Are they once they're assigned, they're forever?
Once these easements are assigned, they are in perpetuity. There is actually a formal conservation deed that is signed and it's recorded in the town, and it's attached to the deed that's the ownership deed that we all have on our properties. Mm-hmm. So in the future, if land is sold, the conservation deed will go right along with the property ownership deed, and all of those rights and restrictions, et cetera, would be carried forward into the future forever.
And how many acres have been protected here in Connecticut under these programs so far?
As of this morning, Connecticut NRCS has placed 194 easements on agricultural land around the state. That's over 17,000 acres. And we have paid out over $52 million in federal funds towards those easements.
Very good. Flipping back to Tom Morgart, Tom, obviously it sounds like this program has been a great success so far. And since it's continuing with these two upcoming application periods, I guess the final question is, once somebody gets a conservation easement through this program, can they still continue to use either the rest of their land or the land that the easement is on as they had prior to it?
So that would depend on the program. So for the agricultural land easement, in that type of easement, we put an easement on there and we're basically restricting the ability to develop that property into another use. It is to remain an agricultural production property. So you can't go and put a housing development on it. You can't put a strip mall on it or, you know, a warehouse on it. It is all about agricultural production. But agricultural production can continue the way it was before, excellent, before the easement was placed. On the wetland reserve easement, we were through the easement process, we take more of those rights away. So if you were, say, that wet field that Carol talked about, that it was growing hay, so we would, with the landowner, develop a restoration plan and restore that land to its prior wetland look and feel, so that land can no longer be farmed through, you know, growing hay or planting corn on it. Mm-hmm. It will be managed as a wetland in perpetuity. The land that is outside the easement can be continued to be managed exactly the way they have the past or however they feel they would like to in the future.
Excellent.
Because we only have an easement on the property that is very clearly outlined in our deed.
Very good. Well, we appreciate the education and information here this morning. Hopefully, there are folks who are listening who either are or know a family or an individual who has attractive land, and maybe they don't want to sell it off directly. They'd like to protect it and kind of keep it in the family. And it sounds like an agricultural or wetland conservation easement might be the answer. If you'd like to find out more about the Natural Resources Conservation Service in Connecticut and this conservation easement programs, you can start at nrcs.usda.gov. Our guests this morning have been Tom and Carol, our guests from the USDA Conservation Office, the NRCS State Conservationist, Tom Morgart, and Assistant State Conservationist for Programs, Carol Grassis. Thank you both for being part of the show this morning, and best of luck with this easement program as we move into 2022. Thanks for your time. Well, as we said in our introduction, so pleased, as always, to welcome new friends and resources to the award-winning For the People. And I was thrilled to see and receive some notification about an initiative that is ramping up for a nonprofit called the Community Mindfulness Project. This organization was formed in 2014 to offer a variety of mindfulness and heart-opening practices to help people support their physical, psychological, emotional, and social well-being, something we could all probably use a little bit more of these days, less stress, more mindfulness. And Erica Long, co-founder of the Community Mindfulness Project, is going to help walk us through how you might be able to take advantage of their programs to benefit your own self-care situation. Erica, great to meet you. Thanks for joining us.
It's a delight to be here. Great to meet you, too.
So let's go back to your background, Erica. Have you always been engaged in things like meditation and mindfulness, or was there a life's event that turned you toward or opened the door for you into this kind of new world of self-care?
Oh, I have not always been involved in it. In fact, I had a career on Wall Street, so real high-stress job. I had a family. And then I started reading a little bit about meditation and mindfulness, and it resonated with me. So I started studying it and digging into it a little bit more. And I found that when I developed a regular practice for myself, even if it was just 5 minutes in the morning before hopping on the train to go into the city, it made me a better investor, it made me a better colleague, a better partner, and a better parent. And it's been with me now for about 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did your career path diverge to the extent that you decided you wanted to begin sharing the gifts that you were enjoying in terms of, you know, mindfulness and peace with a greater community of people here in Connecticut?
Such a great question. It wasn't a direct link from Wall Street to meditation and mindfulness. But I do think that mindfulness helped me to realize when it was time for me to make a move so that I would have better balance in my life, and to make it with a sense of ease and grace. And so took that leap, leaving Wall Street. And then realized that meditation and mindfulness had been so beneficial to me, connected with a couple people in my community who had had a similar experience, and we wanted to make it more accessible to people. One of the things that we realized when we would practice or engage in education around meditation and mindfulness was that there were courses out there that cost several hundred dollars, or you could go on retreats that also cost a fair amount of money. It required a lot of time away from your job or away from caring for your family. And not everybody had those opportunities the way that we did. And yet everyone could benefit from the scientifically based benefits of meditation and mindfulness. So we got together and we made a conscious decision to do what we could to expand access to this. Interestingly, too, it was really advances in medical technology that sort of started in the early 2000s that enabled neuroscientists to study the benefits of meditation and mindfulness on the brain and the body. And a large and growing body of research now shows that meditation and mindfulness can boost immunity, mitigate effects of toxic stress, increase resilience, reduce the symptoms of anxiety and depression. And so as the technology came up and the research came up, we began to feel really passionately that we wanted more people to have access to these tools.
I'm glad you brought that up because obviously for centuries, anecdotal information taught us that practicing meditation or other forms of self-care really do have a significant impact on one's mental and physical well-being. But once brain science and the technology to be able to not just develop, but also kind of cement the benefits into reality from a data-driven perspective, that really kind of turned over all the cards for people that might have been sort of just dismissing all this as, kind of Eastern mysticism or alternative medicine or alternative practice, so to speak.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think there were centuries of people trying these practices and having a first-person experience where they felt they were beneficial, but you couldn't actually prove it. And for a lot of people, meditation was tied back to a faith tradition that might be different than the one that they felt strongly about. And so now that the science can actually show us that if we engage in these practices, they can be beneficial and we can show exactly how that works, then we can take the practices. What we do is we offer secular science-based practices, and we have people from all faith traditions and no faith traditions that join us to engage in these practices. It's becoming more accessible to people and people are more open to it now.
Well, 8 years, going into 8 years now with the Community Mindfulness Project, tell us how this initiative has you know, grown and changed and improved and is now really, you know, not just available to folks in your community or throughout Connecticut, but thanks to the, you know, the virtual world and the ability to access programming basically on your phone from anywhere on the planet where it's happening anywhere else. That has really brought the Mindfulness Project into a huge forefront of kind of top of mind presence for a lot of people.
It has. It's interesting. Before COVID, we would meet regularly in libraries in Fairfield County. And so all of our sessions are free and open to the public. People would come in as they were. We would have people coming in off of a construction job with hard hats and reflective vests on, or people coming on their lunch hour from the office or in their tennis gear, just coming in, sitting in chairs, engaging in this mindfulness practice together for an hour. But it was very much rooted in location, community and location. When COVID hit, we pivoted and we learned how to offer these programs by conference call and by Zoom so that people with either of those technologies could join us. And as a result, we have people from South America that are on our sessions, from all across the United States. And so that has been a little bit of a COVID blossom. And to put it in perspective, since the pandemic began, we began offering 3 sessions a day. We've pulled that back now that people are out in the world a little bit more. We've got 9 sessions a week right now that people can participate in. And we've had about 14,000 participant visits to our programs during that time.
Wow. Well, as we see the headlines, both nationally and especially here in Connecticut, about the crisis of stress and mental health and all of the negative benefits, it's especially raining down on our youngest residents, our school children and students. I guess it's important to point out that your programming is free, it's virtual, and it's accessible to young people as well as everyone else. Talk to us a little bit about, bringing more young people and helping promote getting more younger people into the program. Because as we kind of talked about before we went on the air this morning, I discovered and learned about meditation, back in the mid-70s when I was just entering my teen years. Here I am at 60. And still on occasion tapping into what I learned. It made a big difference in my life as a teenager, and I'm sure it can still serve today's young people who are under this tremendous weight of stress and anxiety.
Sure. And we work with young people in a number of different ways. One thing I'd love to point out is that on the Community Mindfulness Project website, which is communitymindfulnessproject.org, there are recorded meditations and instructions for meditating. Some of them have been written by and recorded by young adults, designed specifically for young adults. We also have meditations on there in Spanish as well. So we work with school districts in Fairfield County. And when we work with the school districts, we have worked with kids in the past. Where we find our point of greatest leverage now is working with the faculty and staff of the school districts. The adults in the building are under themselves like incredible stress, whether it's because of school shootings or COVID. So working with them on their own self-care, their regulation of their nervous system, we know that when the adults in the building are feeling resourced and resilient, that translates into how the kids are feeling. And in fact, the adults in the building can then say, you know, I learned this great tool that's helping me to feel more steady and more at ease, and I'd love to share it with you. It begins to become woven into the school day. Mm-hmm. And then the kids start to feel better, and then they can share that with their families as well. And we do offer some programs for kids. Different libraries and organizations reach out to us, and we do child-specific programming. And it is important. It's when you think back over your life and you think, I wish I'd learned this when I was just a kid, this is one of those things.
Excellent. You also offer a little bit more immersive experiences with one-day retreats.
We do. Before COVID in particular, people could come and spend a day with us from about 9 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon, going through a variety of different practices and really having a whole day where you disconnect from the pressures of the outside world and turn inward and tap into the sense that we are inherently healthy and well. Reconnecting with that sense can be incredibly inspiring.
Mm. So in the last few minutes that we have, let's try to infuse the Community Mindfulness Project with more resources in the form of maybe helping you recruit some facilitators so that we can grow the project.
We would love that. So Community Mindfulness Project is passionate about access, accessibility, and inclusion. We are very much about creating a culture of learning, joint learning, both the teacher and the student learning at the same time. We welcome anyone who's interested in becoming a facilitator to reach out to us via our website. And in addition, we're immensely grateful for any donors that want to support the work that we're doing. In addition to the work that you and I have talked about already, we've done a lot of work with frontline workers and caregivers before the pandemic, but especially during the pandemic. These essential community members are under tremendous stress. So we've been able to work with about 3,000 of them since the pandemic began, and we'd love to be able to continue our work with them. So if there is anyone out there in a nonprofit or that's a frontline caregiver that would like support for your organization, please also feel free to reach out.
Great. And before we let you go, let's touch base and maybe get people involved in the upcoming program that you're doing with Dr. Epstein.
Sure. Thank you for mentioning that. Starting on Thursday, January 27th at 8 p.m., we'll be offering a six-week course, Cultivating Resilience. And that's with Dr. Paul Epstein via Zoom. This program is free and open to anyone that's interested. There's no background necessary. People can drop in for one session. It's better if you can attend all six, but please feel free to drop in for as many as you're interested in doing. Dr. Epstein is a naturopathic physician, a mind-body therapist, a mindfulness teacher, and a speaker specializing in mind-body integrative medicine. So we encourage anyone to participate in that. And once a month, we also have intro to mindfulness sessions in English and Spanish, and then all of our regular programming as well.
And as you mentioned, underwriting is key. So not only can you use the continued support of individuals, but it bears reminding folks of the important support of the Fairfield County's Community Foundation, who has just infused the Community Mindfulness Project with a little bit of underwriting, right?
We can't do any of this work without the support of donors, and FCCF's vote of support for our work has been tremendous over the past couple of years. Recently, they just awarded us a large $10,000 grant for general operating support. That's going to enable us to deepen our outreach into under-resourced communities. We know that the stress associated with living in poverty or without adequate access to employment, housing, nutrition, healthcare, or education causes significant health outcomes. And so by working with communities who face these challenges, we can offer some easily accessible tools to mitigate the effects of elevated stress. And I would love to point out, too, that FCCF doesn't just give us funds. They also help us do what we're doing better by training us in areas like leadership, governance, and fundraising. So sure. We're incredibly fortunate.
Excellent. The Community Mindfulness Project's mission is offering a variety of mindful kindness and heart-opening practices to help people support their physical, psychological, emotional, and social well-being. The organization's founder, co-founder, I should say, has been our guest for this final segment this morning, Erica Long. And Erica, it's been great to meet you, and I look forward to future visits with you, your other co-founders, and individuals all benefiting from this free, publicly accessible programming from the Community Mindfulness Project. Thank you so much for your time today, and we will talk to you again. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.